Let's read again in the Gospel according to Luke chapter 13. Luke chapter 13. And we'll read again verses 15 and 16. Luke 13, verse 15. The Lord then answered him and said, "Thou hypocrite, doth not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or his ass from the stall and lead him away to watering? And ought not this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound, lo, these 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath day?" I want to give you a question that I'd like you to think upon as we read this passage and study it together. The question is this: if Jesus was alive today and were to visit this congregation, who would he seek out first? Jesus was alive today, he visited this congregation, who would he make a beeline for? Have a think about that as we study this passage. I want you to see in this passage three contrasts. First of all, a contrast between the compassionate Christ and a religious ruler. Contrast between the compassionate Christ and a religious ruler. Look, first of all, at the compassion of Christ that's brought before us in this passage. What's here is a disabled woman. We read in verse 11, "Behold, there was a woman which had a spirit of infirmity 18 years and was bowed together and could in no wise lift up herself." And when we read there, she was bowed together, it basically means she was folded up upon herself. In other words, bent double. And she could, we're told here, never straighten herself up. This was not a temporary experience of disability. This was a permanent state she was in. Bowed over, probably so long, 18 years, that the bones were fused together, the muscles were cramped and clamped around her. Everything was just fixed. Now you try that for 15 minutes and see how uncomfortable it is. You've ever tried to work under a car or under a sink or, you know, sat in a vehicle with too many people and you've been squashed into one position for too long? You know, after 15, 20 minutes, you're in a lot of pain. It's very uncomfortable. And this woman has been like this for 18 years. This is a severe and a serious disability. We're told an explanation for it. She's described in verse 11 as having a spirit of infirmity, a spirit of infirmity. And it would appear then that Jesus is tracing this, at least to some degree, to a spiritual cause. And that's confirmed because later on in the passage, in verse 16, Jesus described this woman not only as a daughter of Abraham, but someone whom Satan has bound, lo, these 18 years. And clearly here, God had permitted Satan to afflict this woman as he permitted the devil to afflict Job. He permitted the devil to afflict this woman with a disability. There was a satanic element to this. Now, that's not the case for all disabilities, of course. Remember in John chapter 9, the disciples saw a blind man and they ran to the conclusion that it was a spiritual cause to this. And they said, "Who sinned, this man or his parents?" And Jesus said, neither. This isn't about that. This man has this disability of blindness in order that the glory of God would be seen. So clearly there are different causes of disability that are very difficult for us to figure out, but more commonly, God is permitting it, not for a sin in a person, but for the glory of God, as in this case. But here clearly, the devil was involved. And yet, for all the physical disability, for all the spiritual assault upon her, she was not rebelling against God. Indeed, she was seeking out God. We're told here Jesus was teaching in one of the synagogues on a Sabbath, and this disabled woman made her way to the synagogue. In other words, she couldn't look up physically, but she was looking up spiritually. She was looking up by faith to the only one who could help her. She was going to the right person in the right place at the right time. And her faith, whether it was saving or not, she had some sufficient faith to get her out the door and to get her along the road and to get her into the synagogue. And it appears as if she enters, and Jesus sees her. Because we're told here, and behold, there was a woman. So the picture of the synagogue has been painted, the people are in it, Jesus is teaching, and behold, look, something different has happened. The scene has changed. It's really implying that at that moment, when everyone's gathered, everyone's settled, in comes this latecomer. Probably the story of her life. Due to her disability, this was what she was used to. She was always last. And she was always pushed out the way, probably always just bringing up the rear. But regardless, we see here a very good example of the last shall be first. Because as she comes in, we read, and when Jesus saw her, Jesus picks her out of the crowd. There's a mass of people here. He's teaching, and yet his eye locks on her. His heart goes out to her. So much so that he interrupts and disrupts his teaching. And he calls her to him. In the middle of his sermon, in the middle of his teaching, he calls her out. And he calls her to the front. And she's shuffling up the aisle, all eyes upon her. And Jesus says to her, woman, you are loosed from your infirmity. Loosed. And nothing seems to happen. Nothing seems to happen. Because we read something else here. And he laid his hands on her. So he speaks, woman, you're loosed, you're unbound, you're freed. And to the human eye, nothing happens. But something's happened. It's just it's not seen yet. It's not been manifested yet. As soon as Jesus speaks, there's healing. But you try and put yourself in her position. You've been bent double for 18 years. You've seen the ground for 18 years. And you're brought to the front of this synagogue. And you hear these words. And where the word of a king is, there is power. And as soon as Jesus says, be loosed, these bones that had fused begin to break apart, separate. All the cramped and clamped muscles are freed. All the nerve endings that had been so warped and distorted and damaged are healed. Everything happens in that very moment. But she doesn't move. No doubt she could feel something different. You can't have such a change go on in your body and not sense it. In the few seconds it took to utter these words, something massive has happened inside her. And it's as if she doesn't dare move. If you haven't moved for 18 years, are you going to immediately stand up? Is it safe? Will I break? Will I further damage myself? Any previous attempt to stand up has been met with resistance and pain and discomfort. And so Jesus reaches out and he puts his hands on her, we read. He laid his hands on her. And then, immediately, she was made straight. The compassionate heart of Jesus located her. The compassionate words of Jesus healed her. The compassionate hands of Jesus straightened her up, gave her the confidence to leverage her back into the right position. And we read she was made straight, immediately, completely, beautifully straight. What compassion. And she glorified God. She probably spoke out words of praise or even sang a song of praise, or as others did when they were healed by Jesus of physical problems, danced joyfully before the Lord. We don't know how she glorified God, but she did. The compassion of Jesus brought her to worship and to praise. And of course, the response to this compassion of Christ, the response to this amazing miracle, the response to this beautifully straight woman who'd previously been bent double and twisted in agony, the response was widespread joy and jubilation and celebration, wasn't it? Far from it. Far from it. We read in verse 14 a tremendous contrast with the compassion of Christ. And the ruler of the synagogue answered with indignation. Indignation. That's fury. That's anger. Because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath day. It's incredible, isn't it? He's hopping mad. Because Jesus healed this woman on the Sabbath day. Here's this ruler of the synagogue. He's the man of order. He's the church order guy. He's the guy who's in charge of getting everything orderly and right and running along the right lines and smoothly with no disruption, no trouble. And this has disrupted his day big time. This woman's come in and disrupted things, interrupted the sermon, and now she's glorifying God exuberantly, joyfully, and he is incensed at such a disruption. Especially, he's especially upset because of the day it was done on, the Sabbath day. And he turns, he doesn't even have the courage to face Jesus, he turns to the people. Turns to the people. Imagine that. He comes, as it were, to the front of the church, and he turns to the people and he rebukes them, including her. And he says, there are 6 days in which men ought to work. In them, therefore, come and be healed, and not on the Sabbath day. He's saying, can we not schedule this? I mean, can we not arrange for this to be done on Tuesday or Wednesday? But the Sabbath day, the holy day, he's furious at this. And it's a striking and serious and horrific contrast with this massive, compassionate heart of Christ and this shriveled, furious, angry heart of this religious leader. And Christ's words to him are so apt. The Lord answered him and said, You hypocrite. And you know, as we'll see as we go on, although he used the Sabbath day as his outward excuse, he presented this as his very holier-than-thou reason why this woman should not have been healed. He's up there at front, all righteous and all indignant, looking down his nose at this rabble and protesting the sanctity of the Sabbath day. And Jesus said, you're just a big actor. This is all a pretense. This is nothing about the Sabbath day. You're not angry about that. What's he angry about? As we're about to see, what he was angry about was mercy. Mercy. Grace. Love to the undeserving. That's what got under his skin. That's what got up his nose. That's what rankled him. That's what filled his heart with red hot fury. Jesus dealing with someone graciously, mercifully, not as they deserve. This was alien to him. This was totally unacceptable. That's why Jesus said, you're a hypocrite. That's not the real reason. But the compassionate heart of Christ here is held out to us in all its attracting and compelling power. And then he points us to a second contrast, that between the disabled woman and a thirsty donkey. A disabled woman and a thirsty donkey. He turns to this religious leader, he rebukes him in this way, and then asks him this question. Does not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or his ass, his donkey from the stall, and lead him away to watering? So he paints this picture of them all doing their thing with their donkeys. And ought not this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound, lo, these 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath day? He's bringing here a contrast between this disabled woman and a thirsty donkey. And he's saying, first of all, contrast their natures. Contrast their natures. Here, on the one hand, religious leader, you've got your donkey, an animal with no soul that you're so concerned about. On the other hand, here we have a woman made in the image of God, a woman with an immortal soul, a soul that will never die. Ought not this woman, as opposed to this donkey, be our greatest concern? Then he contrasts their relationship. He speaks of your donkey, you loose your donkey. So the relationship is, here's a man and a donkey. How does he describe this woman's relationship? He describes her as a daughter of Abraham. What does that mean? Well, there are two views. Some people say this is an expression that describes her as a child of faith, who is somebody, a daughter of Abraham, who has the faith of Abraham, a spiritual child of Abraham, in other words. Other people say, no, it's a term for somebody in the covenant community, not necessarily saved, maybe, but covenantally a daughter of Abraham. Now, whatever that true relationship is, it's certainly far more valuable and far more important than you and your donkey. Then he contrasts their bindings, and he says, about you guys with your donkeys, he says, does not each one of you in the Sabbath loose his ox or his ass? So he's saying, look at the binding here. It's a rope or a piece of leather between the donkey's nose and a bar or a piece of wood. Okay, that's the bond. That's the band that you untie. Look at the band of this woman. It's not a rope or a piece of leather. She's been bound by Satan. It's a satanic bond that she's suffering under? Is that not far more important than a piece of leather? A piece of rope? Then he says, compare their suffering. Your donkey's thirsty. Big deal. Thirst. Look at this woman. She's bent double. She cannot straighten herself. She's got a serious disability. What's that? Far more serious, far more significant, far more deserving of attention than a donkey's dry tongue. Then he compares the time. A donkey's tongue might be thirsty for a few minutes or even a couple of hours. This woman suffered for 18 years. Again, where are our priorities? And then he compares the effort involved. You go and you have to get out of the synagogue, you've got to go find your donkey, you've got to then untie it, and you've got to lead it along, you've got to take it to the water, you've got to give it its drink, you've got to bring it back. That takes time, that takes effort, that takes energy. That takes a lot of work. What have I done? Be loosed. You're all upset about work on the Sabbath day? You do all that for a donkey, and you don't let me just speak two words? Look at the deliverance. A donkey, you're delivering a donkey so that it's not thirsty anymore. What's that compared to what I've done for this woman who's straight, who's beautiful, who's complete, who's whole again? Thirst quenched for a couple of hours, or healed for many years to come? Look at the day. I've done this on one Sabbath day. Every single Sabbath day you have to do this for your donkeys. You see the contrast that Jesus is drawing here, the stark contrast to expose the evil and the hypocrisy and the wickedness of the human heart on one side, and the love and the compassion and the mercy of Christ on the other side. He's saying, just compare this thirsty donkey and this disabled woman. Compare their natures. Compare their relationship. Compare their bond. Compare their suffering. Compare the time. Compare the energy involved. Compare the deliverance. Compare that we've just done this one day and you do this every day. When you look at these two, he says, ought not this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound low these 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath day? He's saying, this isn't just optional for me. It's not, hey, wouldn't this be a good idea? He's saying, ought not this to happen? If you feel an obligation and an oughtness and a should-do-ness to care for your donkey, ought not, should not I do this for this woman? He's saying, I feel it as a moral, a divine, a spiritual imperative. This is why he came. And then thirdly, we have a contrast between friends and enemies. Friends and enemies. As he explains this, the atmosphere crystallizes and clarifies. Verse 17, when he had said these things, all his adversaries were ashamed. They weren't repentant. They were ashamed. They were embarrassed. They weren't humbled. They were humiliated. They felt the power of this contrast that had been painted that made them look so bad and so evil, so merciless, so loveless. The adversaries were ashamed, but all the people rejoiced. for all the glorious things that were done by him. There's no middle ground here. You cannot be neutral when it comes to responding to Christ and reacting to Christ's grace and mercy and love. You either hear it and hate it, or you listen to it and you love it. You hear about grace and it riles you and it irritates you and you feel it's unfair and unjust, or you hear it and you say, this is my hope. This is my life. This is my joy. This is what would make me glorify God all the days of my life and for all eternity. Friends and enemies, for him or against him. So what can we draw from this miracle? What lessons can we learn? Well, the first lesson is there's a much bigger contrast. There's a much deeper contrast. There's a much more serious contrast here than between a compassionate Christ and a religious leader. Much more than the contrast between a thirsty donkey and a disabled woman. Much more of a contrast than between the friends of Christ and the enemies of Christ. Because at the root of this conflict is the contrast that we find in Genesis 3:15. Between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. This is ultimately the climactic conflict between God and the devil, between heaven and hell. It's a further outworking of that conflict that began with the first gospel promise in Genesis 3:15. It's a cosmic battle. This isn't just an earthly battle, it's cosmic. It's spiritual. This is about spiritual wickedness in high places. Behind this synagogue is a spiritual world. Behind this contrast are spiritual enemies. And the conflict here reveals the nature of the foes, the enemies, the two opposing forces. That each one of us is aligned behind. One or the other. It's not so much are you with the religious ruler or Jesus, are you with the donkey or the disabled woman, it's are you with God or with the devil. You know, but we're all participants in this cosmic battle. Whether we like it or not, whether we're conscious of it or not, we are on one side or the other. And a miracle like this reminds us of the ultimate winner of this battle. And it's Christ. He won, as it were, a little skirmish here in the ongoing conflict that pictures the ultimate, final, and complete victory. There was a man in my father's congregation in Scotland. He's gone to be with the Lord now, but he was what's known in Scotland as the village idiot. That's a very harsh term to use, but he was a simple man, but he was also a drunk. He was an alcoholic. And was renowned for all the wrong things in the village. He was the laughing stock, if you like. And he also had polio from an early age in his life, and very disabled, very broken body. It was almost horrible to look at, if I'm honest. A man very, very broken by sin. And yet, this little man, who again could hardly look up, he was so broken, he could never make eye contact with, he was so small and so stiff with the polio, and his innards so gnawed out by the alcohol, just misshapen in every way. He was wonderfully saved, amazingly saved by the grace of God. Do you think the village rejoiced? No. If they mocked him and laughed at him before, it was intensified 10 times afterwards. If they before wanted to draw him into temptation and sin, they wanted to do it 10 times more afterwards. And the amount of tactics and attempts they used to try and draw him back to the pub, draw him back to that lifestyle, just incredible, heartless, merciless. They couldn't stand the grace of God that God would choose Eric, the village idiot, to be saved. And Eric would often give his testimony whenever you spoke to him. He probably couldn't remember doing it before, so he kept on doing it. And he would often tell about the attempts that were made to bring him back to the crowd, bring him back to the gang. This time he's mid-40s. He died probably in his mid-50s. There's one phrase that sticks in my mind. He said it every single time I spoke with him. And I know he said it to others too. As he told his story and he told about the latest attempts to draw him back, he always said back to them, "I'll stick with the winners. I'll stick with the winners." Wasn't much of a defense. He couldn't think things through, great theology at all, but he knew the winning side was Christ's. And this miracle calls you to the winning side. It's saying there's only one victor, and it's the great, compassionate, conquering Christ, who is on the Lord's side. Who is on the Lord's side? As Joshua said, "Let him come to me." Cosmic contrast. Second thing we find here is the purpose, the real purpose of the Sabbath day. You know, as you read the Gospels, it's amazing how many times Jesus chooses to do something like this on the Sabbath day, knowing the reaction. And there's always this reaction. It's what seemed to get him into trouble most, healing people on the Sabbath day. And as you read, you think, well, why not wait till the next day? Why not do it the day before? Why? It's because he's making a point. This is not coincidental. It's not just provocation. No, it's fighting for the beautiful original meaning of the Sabbath day, which was to remember the original creation of God and celebrate God's recreating work in humanity. These two viewpoints, these two ways of looking at the Sabbath, it's to remember and celebrate God's original work of creation, but also to celebrate his ability to recreate what had been uncreated. The Sabbath was to destroy the works of the devil, to demolish his work of devastating the sons and daughters of men, and to rebuild and recreate in the image of Christ new creatures. That was what the Sabbath day is all about, and that's why Jesus kept doing this on the Sabbath day. It's to keep communicating. The Sabbath day is about recreation. It's about renewing. It's about putting back together what's been pulled apart by sin. It's about building up what's been broken down. It's about making beautiful what's been made ugly. It's to celebrate the ability of Christ to recreate humanity. That's why we gather here on a Sunday. It's to celebrate. It's not to keep a rule. It's not to keep a law merely. It's to come for recreation. It's to come to be made new. No, maybe our bodies are not going to be healed in this way, but something far more important is our souls. Our souls, which are folded in upon themselves. Some of us not just for 18 years, but maybe even for 80. can still be unfolded, can still be opened up, can still be made whole. Jesus still feels this moral imperative, this moral and spiritual and divine obligation to make whole, to loose on the Sabbath day. You come to church with that prayer, believer and unbeliever. However long we've been believing, we still have spiritual disability to be healed and made whole. Thirdly, we take away from this, Jesus puts the disabled center stage in his church. Jesus puts the disabled center stage in his church. Jesus here disrupted the order of the church. He ruined the harmony and the regularity. And again, it wasn't accidental. It was intentional. He brought this woman to the front, as he did with so many others on the Sabbath day. And he put them at the front, and he passed over so many others to give them unique and special and focused and priority attention. Again, this is not just a one-off. This was repeated, and it's with a purpose. It's with a message. It's with a call to his church to do the same. Come back to my question. If Jesus visited this church tonight, who would he prioritize? Who would he make a beeline for? What do these miracles tell us? They tell us he would make a beeline, he would make a priority of connecting with the broken in body and the broken in mind, and the broken in heart. Does that offend you? Usually they're at the back of the line in the world. But Jesus says they should be the first in the line in the church. Many of us might think, well, I would probably be pretty near the front. I might not be first, but, you know, I'll be in the first 10. If you think like that, you're probably in the last 10. You say, well, I mean, you know, this is pretty bad. These people thinking more of their donkeys than the disabled. That wouldn't happen today, would it? How much money and how many hours are spent each week on the care of dogs and cats and rabbits and birds and gerbils and frogs and fish compared with caring for, time for, and money in the disabled? Are we any different? Where are our priorities? It looks different in our day. Jesus would probably change the words, but it's the same principle. He's saying you've got to change your priorities. You've got to put at the center those who are often on the outskirts, on the circumference. You've got to prioritize, you've got to focus. Jesus puts the disabled and the broken at the very center and forefront of his care, and therefore does the same in his call to the church. How each one of us fulfills that is going to vary, but the call is universal. This was not incidental to Jesus' mission. It's right at the heart of it. Lastly, this miracle calls us to anticipate heaven. Because what's done here is a little taster, a little appetizer of the final full healing of all God's people. You look at some of the messianic prophecies, the prophecies predicting what Jesus would do when he came. Isaiah 35, the eyes of the blind shall be opened and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap as a hart and the tongue of the dumb shall sing. For in the wilderness shall waters break out and streams in the desert. That was fulfilled in Christ's first coming. And then later on in Isaiah, in chapter 61, where Jesus is prophetically speaking, the Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good tidings to the meek. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to them that are bound. What a fulfillment we find even here in Luke's Gospel. Many pages of the Gospel, but still incomplete. It's not finished. It's hardly begun. These were just little samples of Christ's great work that lies ahead. To do this on a universal scale for all his people. These words will never be fully fulfilled till the resurrection. They are partially fulfilled in the intermediate state as believers go to heaven, but they still await their bodies, they still await the full healing. And one of the greatest joys in heaven, if here we read of people rejoicing and glorifying God, what will it be like in heaven? When we see the blind who'd lived their whole lives sightless, seeing with their own eyes for the first time. You seen any of these videos of people who are colorblind getting these special glasses and seeing color for the first time? It's astonishing. They're weeping, they're crying, not with sadness, with joy, with gladness. They're seeing. What would it be like for the blind? And what about the deaf? Again, have you seen these videos of people getting cochlear implants and they hear for the first time? They hear their husband or their wife or their mother. They hear their voice for the first time. What joy, what gladness. You think of those who have lived with disability like this. When they're reunited with their perfect body, a vile body transformed to be made like unto Christ's glorious body, then shall the lame man leap as a hart, as a deer. You imagine all the leaping that will go on in heaven that day as people get their legs and their bodies healed for the first time. The dumb shall sing. Those whose tongues were tightened and they're unable to articulate words, they'll be able to speak the most glorious words about Christ and sing the most wonderful hymns. The tone deaf will sound like Pavarotti. What about those with autism who've never felt feelings as we do, who have never really known how to love or be loved? Then they will know love as they have never known. Then will they love as they have never known. What about those whose minds were disabled, who were unable to process normal thoughts? They'll be like Einstein. They'll be geniuses. Those with emotional disorders, the depressed and the bipolar and the schizophrenic and all the other disorders, gone, gone. But you know, really, all of us suffer from these things to one degree or another. We think we're not depressed. You know, when we get to heaven, we'll all realize we were totally depressed. Just some were worse than others. We think we're not disabled in this world. When we get to heaven, we'll think, I never knew what it was like to have a body made like unto Christ's glorious body. We all think we're so clever and bright compared to some. We're not even in elementary school compared to what we'll be, even the brightest of us. The capacities, the abilities, the completeness and the fullness of Christ's work. And, you know, even spiritually, we think, you know, that we know what it is to know the love of Christ, which passes knowledge, and then we'll know that we hardly began to know. We hardly began. We think we know Christ, and we'll realize, we really, compared to then, he was really virtually a stranger to us. We think we've known fellowship and friendship here. When we get there, we'll look back on this earth and it'll be like we were illegal aliens. What an anticipation. What a prospect in such a short time. It's not going to be long, God's people. If you are God's people. If you are Christ's. If not, this is just not for you. Nothing of this. Just go exactly the opposite way. The contrast is, it couldn't be greater. Surely this miracle gives you a longing for healing of body and soul that Christ alone can give you. Let's pray.